I know people came to hear Dr. Diamond, and I'll just like briefly introduce you and thank him. I'm sure you all know he's a professor at the University of Waterloo, and he's really an expert on the Rambam. His second book on the Rambam is coming out in the fall. And without further ado, I'll let him start. And I think the Starbucks coffee will be ready soon.
Thanks.
Oh, later. But okay.
By the way, I'm not live.
You're not virtual.
It's interesting that actually I was just listening to that, so it just occurred to me, maybe I'll start off with something provocative. Maybe not provocative in this audience, not provocative in some audiences. Rabbi Liebtag was talking about Korbanot, from what I heard, I didn't realize he was live. But from what I heard, virtually everything he said, I think possibly Maimonides or the Rambam, Ibn Maimun, we'll talk about that in a second, would have disagreed with. That is, Korbanot representing some kind of spiritual transformation, some kind of elevation. We'll get beyond that, maybe, to a purely functional kind of idea of Korbanot. So to give you an idea, I once did a drasha on the Rambam's Agada, or the Agada, that we just finished Pesach, so the Rambam's Agada, that's carried on in the Nusach of the Teimanim, starts off with kind of a koteret, a heading that says, Bivhilu Yatsanu B'Mitzrayim. So Bivhilu Bahala is kind of the translation, sometimes the Bivhilu, the Aramaic translation of the Chipazon. I'm not going to go through my drasha, but the long and short of it was that the significance of this for me, and that just started off the Maimonidean Haggadah, was that Pesach was virtually defined and informed when it was the real Pesach, that is during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, by the Korban Pesach, by a ritual that the Rambam by and large found to be temporal, historical, anthropologically, sociologically rooted in the times of the ancient Near East. Well, hopefully we'll get into that a little bit later on in the year. So I thought that at the end, my conclusion was Bifhilu Yatsanu Mitzrayim, that Bifhilu in a couple of senses of the word, that is, Behala can also mean confusion, it can mean quickness, that is, there is some confusion about what Korbanot mean. We want to get as quickly as we can over Korbanot so that we can get on to the next phase. So that was the conclusion of my drasha, that why the Maimonidean Haggadah started with that. So I'll start with that, and maybe we'll work through these classes towards what I began with. Now, I don't know, it's kind of hard for me to prepare for these, because I don't know the dynamic of the class. I gave out handouts that are in Hebrew, so I don't know if everybody here know Hebrew? To some extent or another, I assume. I don't want to put anybody on the spot. If please stop me if there's a problem. I'll translate everything that we go through. Just my computer doesn't have the English, so I just pasted from my CD-ROM these passages. Before we get into the actual material, a little introduction. I'm sure everybody here has heard of Maimonides. If you haven't heard of Maimonides, you've certainly heard of the Rambam. If you haven't heard of the Rambam, nobody here, but other communities know him as Ibn Maimun, or in a Christian community, known as Rabbi Moses, particularly by Thomas Aquinas, who referred to him quite a bit. So just from the different names that he's known by, the Latinized name Maimonides, the name that he's known by in Yeshiva, you won't go into Lakewood and find him being referred to as Maimonides, right? He's referred to as a Rambam. Gives you an idea about the complexity of this figure that we're going to deal with. And the problems in studying him and reading his works. The names reflect the major problem, probably, with somebody like the Rambam, more than anybody else. It happens with lots of figures. And that is, people tend to fragmentize him and see him and only read that which relates to what they're interested in or what fits their particular paradigm or their particular theology or their particular science. So in, for instance, yeshivot, you will virtually not, except maybe in some small circles that are learning it on the side, will not, they will not engage the Rambam's philosophical oeuvre, their philosophical work. They're by and large engaged in his halachic work. In the scholarly world, on the other hand, there is an imbalance as well. As I have to tell you, that no more ink has been spilled in both these worlds than on the Rambam. In both the scholarly worlds, that is in the academic world and in the yeshiva world. But there is likewise an imbalance in the scholarly world. That is, I find, I kind of crossed over from one world into another. I kind of still have a foot in both worlds. It's hard, but I find there's also an imbalance in the scholarly world that is also very, very split, very divided between those who are only concerned with his philosophical work and have no interest whatsoever in his halakha works. I'm not saying this is across the board. There are some scholars who cross both. Professor Menachem Kellner, for instance, is one. I urge you to read anything by him who crosses both worlds. But And also, in the scholarly world, those who engage his philosophical works are largely populated by Islamists. That is, people who are really interested in Arabic philosophy or Islamic philosophy and kind of look at Maimonides as just a branch or somebody who's been influenced by Islam and the culture and the philosophy that was going on in his time. And that's certainly true. However, he was a man, one man, that composed many works. Every human being, I find, is complex. And this is the problem that we have today. The problem that people always have had is understanding people as complex figures. It goes on today. You could see it, for instance, with somebody like Russ Soloveitchik. Almost the same kinds of arguments. Those who see him and who can relate to his philosophical works relate to his philosophical works. Those who have no philosophical sensibility, I don't mean here to put them down, but who are only interested in halakha will relate to his halakhic works and belittle the philosophical works. That is, either say, you know, you hear the usual things, he's engaged in it for apologetic purposes, he doesn't really want to engage it, but he has to because the modern times call for it. However, this, I think, I don't think, I know, is the wrong approach. That is, people, again, are complex, and you have to look at them as a whole. Now, not only are they complex, but complexity also breeds contradictions. So, that is, if you're looking for absolute consistency in any human being, you're not going to find it. What they do often in the yeshiva world, which is try to harmonize inconsistent positions, is often the wrong approach and often takes you down the wrong road. So I'm not going to present here a person without problems. That is, his work is not necessarily monolithic. That is, there isn't everything here that you could put together in a puzzle that would become one consistent picture. And that's a function of his being a human being like we all are. And not only that, but people tend to forget that people grow. People also develop. So that the Rambam wrote works throughout his life. And not only do we surmise, but we know he changed his mind many times. We actually have some of his own kitayat where we have him crossing out things and putting in other things. So we know, you know, he wrote things when he was young, and that's what I would expect. I wouldn't expect a 70-year-old man to be the same or to think the same or maybe to hold the same positions that he did when he was 20 years old. Otherwise, he hasn't evolved and he hasn't matured. So this is probably another problem with trying to find the consistent Rambam or the consistent Maimonides. as the joke goes, there's Maimonides, there's your Maimonides, there's his Maimonides, there's her Maimonides. So that tells you a little bit of truth in that joke. So the complexity of the man, a little bit of an introduction. I don't know how many of you are familiar with kind of his life, his biography, but in order to understand the material that we are going to get into, one has to understand a little bit about the times. He was born, just give you a little biographical kind of introduction. I'm not a historian, so I'm not that interested in biography and history, but of course it often goes together with thought. The milieu that a person grows up in, the influences that surround him, all go into, are the ingredients that go into understanding a person's work. He was born in, and scholars have fiddled around with this, by and large now, it used to be 1135, now it's 1137, 1138, whatever. A couple of years difference doesn't make a large shift.
He was younger when he went to...
That's right.
Schneid, instead of being 20, he was 18 when he
right,
went.
Right, whatever. So, so 1138, let's say, which is this kind of the scholarly consensus now, and died in 1205. So the period we're dealing with here is the 12th century. He started off, though he's largely known as the Spanish, you know, he didn't really spend much time in Spain. He started off born in Cordoba. So if you go to Spain, I've been to Cordoba. There's a large Maimonides industry there now because they're trying to cater to... there's a hotel Maimonides. There are stores. What's that? Yeah. So there's stores that, even though there's no Jews that live there, there's a Jewish store there that sells stuff. I was talking to the guy actually, and I thought the guy wasn't even Jewish that owned the store, but he's selling stuff, a whole shelf of Maimonides stuff. Sorry if I digress sometimes, but sometimes something pops into my head. But when I was there, Maimonides has a... this is just apropos what I said about culture, the cultural milieu that a person grows up in and how that affects him. Maimonides uses a very, very important metaphor at the beginning of his work in the Guide of Perplexed about the various levels to Torah. That is, there are various levels. We all know that, various levels of meaning. What he means by various levels is something maybe different than what somebody else means, like Rashi or Ramban, let's say. But he compares the Torah, the various levels, to apples of gold in silver filigree. Right? Silver filigree work. So there's an apple of gold that's contained in a casing of silver filigree. So he says, when you are distant from it and you look at it, all you see is the silver because you don't really see the apertures from a distance. When you start to get closer and closer, the apertures start to come into your vision. And then you start to see the gold peeking out. You can imagine what this metaphor is about. But when I was in Spain and I was in Cordoba and was walking the streets, especially in the old section, there was store after store after store that sold filigree work, silver filigree work. And then I was asking people, and they're telling me this is a trade that's been handed down, from generation to generation. And it just, to me, it kind of... I saw through the apertures here. It was like an amazing thing to just think that, you know, the Rambam's walking around when he's a kid, walking past the artisans who are doing this. And, you know, this is why he used... people don't... just give you an example. People don't grow up in a vacuum, right? They draw on the things that are around them. And certainly the Rambam, this is just a very, maybe trivial example. We'll see that even architecture, Islamic architecture, which is very different than the Gothic architecture, than the Christian architecture, also I think influenced maybe, or which way the influence goes, that our architecture is a function of the way people think. So that's just a small example. But he spent very little time in Cordoba. He left around Bar Mitzvah. Whether he had his Bar Mitzvah in Cordoba or not, I don't know. But... this may sound familiar to us in modern times. There was a band of radical Islamists, fundamentalist Islamists, who were actually imposing Islam forcibly, called the Almohads, Almoravids, and going through Spain, conquered large parts of Spain, and well before what we all know as the Spanish Inquisition and the whole Murano experience, there was already a Murano experience going on in Spain in Islamic culture. So when they tell you that, when you hear the apologists in Islam often saying that, you know, the Jews fared so much better under Islam and the Christians were, it is true to some extent, but here I'm giving you an example of where there are cracks in this theory. That is, it's not that simple. So that already in the 13th, in the 12th century, you already had, well before the Inquisition, already a Murano experience in Judaism. That is, people were converting to Islam. Jews were converting to Islam under this rule. In fact, you have, and this is by and large, there are some Jewish scholars, but by and large, Muslim scholars, you can understand this, that claim that Maimonides was one of them. Maimonides actually converted to Islam. There's a certain period of life we don't kind of know what was going on, but that Maimonides actually converted to Islam. We'll leave that aside. But his family, from that point on, from the time that he was about Bar Mitzvah, left Cordoba and kind of was in a perpetual state of wandering, exile. So they went from there to northern Spain and eventually ended up in North Africa, in Morocco, and spent some time there, made their way to Israel, Palestine. It was a possibility, but not a very feasible possibility, as you probably all know. You know what was going on around this time in, this wasn't the Israel of modern day. This was the 12th century, the 1100s. Anybody knows what's going on in the Crusades? This is not a really good time, neither for Christians nor for Muslims, but certainly not for Jews who are kind of in the middle. Whatever reason he went to Israel, quickly realized that this, pretty quickly, that this was not the place that he could function, and then eventually made his way to Egypt, to Cairo, to Old Cairo, which is called Fustat, and there is really where he established his career by which we know Rambam, by which we know Maimonides. His stay in Cairo, which was not free of troubles, but was a place he could function, rose to fair bit of prominence, both, of course, in the Jewish world and the Islamic world. He became quite a prominent doctor, so prominent that he was actually a court physician in the court of one of the most famous Muslim conquerors, who's actually occurred, one of the most famous Muslim conquerors that managed to kick out the Christians for a time from Jerusalem, Salah ad-Din Saladin. He was actually in his court. Now, whether he actually treated Saladin or not, we don't know, but we do know that he treated his son. And we do know that he wrote a treatise for some of the family and the son's problems. And the problems were primarily sexual problems. So this is, we know he wrote a treatise about that to help him out. Kind of one of the first, maybe precursor to Viagra, if you want to call it that. The court, Saladin or whoever's running the court, is not going to let in a slouch, right, to be the doctor. He's going to let in a Jewish doctor, right? The Jew is the one you want as a doctor. So during this period is the period that he becomes, in a sense, the Maimonides that we know. Not to say that he didn't write things or start writing things before he ended up in Fustat or Old Cairo. The major works of his, the major ones, and there are fragments of ones, but the major ones that we know of, he wrote when he was a teenager, a young man. He wrote a treatise on logic, which is pretty well based on Aristotelian logic, which gives you an idea already at the time that he's 16, what kind of a mind this is or where his mind is going. And I'll just chronologically, the Perush HaMishnayot, right, his commentary on the Mishnah, was written also quite young, completed when he was about 30, something like that. Then the Mishnah Torah, which is we're all familiar with, and then towards the end of his life, the Guide of the Perplexed. So one can look at it, depending on which community you belong to, as a hierarchy going this way, or if you belong in some communities, it's a hierarchy going this way. So, you know, this is subject to debate, although, to my mind, not subject to debate, and we'll see why. So let me give you just, I want to get into the material, but biography is a little bit important. So as you see, the places that he lived in, the culture that he grew up in, is very, very different than the culture of some of the Ashkenazic Gedolim that we're all familiar with, and pick one most prominent, Rashi. Right? Rashi lived before the Rambam in the 11th century. We have no real indications in the Rambam anywhere that he actually knew of Rashi. He may have. He never ever, I think, in his entire, somebody may correct me here, but I think that nowhere in his entire work does he ever refer to Rashi. But certain, what's that?
Were other people in the 12th century living in Spain aware of Rashi?
Sure, there were people. I mean, after
at the time of the Rambam.
At the time of the Rambam, I'm not sure.
It's just his thing,
yeah.
He would never
his works just Rashi. Don't forget. We're not. You're right. It is amazing. But not so amazing because, don't forget, we're talking about a time when...
No, I realize that. Yeah. That's why I want to know if other people...
Yeah, it could be, but I'm not sure. We don't even know. He may have known of the Ibn Ezra, for instance, but we don't know for sure. The Ramban, of course, right, who is later than the Ramban, knows very much of Rashi, and in fact, his commentary is, I think, almost formulated to combat Rashi. That's what I think. But he set out to really knock Rashi down completely.
In a respectful way.
In a respect, but that's what he always says. Everybody's respectful.
Right.
Everybody says, you know, like the Rambam is also respectful, but you know when they're talking, you know, that they're, I mean, I'll give you an example. Again, I'm digressing a little bit here, but I've been working on the Ramban, because I've been getting typecast. So I walked into a conference one day, and one of the mystical scholars said, oh, there's the Maimonides guy. I don't know. You know, that's all I know. I guess, okay, I'm a bore. Like, that means I'm a boring guy, right? The mystical guys, because Madonna's infamous, isn't there, the exciting ones. So, I decided to get into the Ramban, not because of that. But the Ramban, for instance, you're right, very respectful. In his introduction to his commentary, he mentions primarily Ibn Ezra and Rashi. And when he says...
The Rambam isn't as you know, the Rambam is not really what you call it respectful.
He's not, but they have a language. You know, there's a kind of a language where there's a superficial respect, but you know behind the language there's something going on. So, for instance, there is a phrase that struck me when the Ramban in his introduction and says how he's going to engage with Ibn Ezra and Rashi. So Ibn Ezra, he says, I'm going to engage with him with open rebuke and concealed love. Okay, so it gives you an idea of what he thinks of him as open rebuke and concealed love. I think the concealed emotion is usually the more important one. And it's the one that he really feels. Rashi, he says, he goes for quite a few lines, how great Rashi is. And then he says, below Mishpat HaBechorah, you know, he has, to him belongs the law of primogeniture, of he's the elder one. And I thought to myself, you know, what happens, this is a commentary on the Torah, what happens to every single Bechor in the Torah? Every single one.
Gets taken away.
Every single one is usurped by the younger one. So who knows? I'm not saying for sure. But I'm just saying, when he says that, you know, when the medievals talked, right, you can't just take things at face value. That is, he's drawing here on a biblical expression, Velo Mishpat HaBechorah, which is the actual law. But he's also drawing on, well, what happened to every single Bechor, you know? Okay, to him belongs the law, but the law is never applied, never, Never, ever in the entire... I mean, this is a trope, right? This is a constant motif. All through Bereishit, Moshe is the younger one, Aaron, right? David is the youngest one. This is always the case. Right, right. So this is always the motif. For whatever reason, we won't get into that. We can have a whole course on that too. But maybe that's what he means, right? You could take it as you will. You could take it as you will. Just to give you an idea of the kind of person we're talking about and how he ever got to write what he did, considering the time that he devoted to various ventures, various enterprises in his life, carrying on kind of a double full-time practice. I'm going to start before, and then we'll get into the material, because I know you're all waiting to get into the material, but we have a letter. We have a number of letters from the Rambam, some that we found, in his own handwriting in the Geniza, the famous Cairo Geniza. And we have one very famous one that actually tells us what his Seder Hayom was, what his daily schedule was. So towards the end of the 12th century, when he completed the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, which is a philosophical work, which raises another problem that I didn't mention. The other problem with studying the Rambam is that some of his main works he wrote not in Hebrew. Yeah. Right? He wrote in not even in Arabic, but Judeo-Arabic. That is, this gives you a kind of a symbol, a very nice symbol of the times, the sign of the times. That is, Judeo-Arabic is Arabic written in Hebrew characters. Right? So that's how the two cultures are intertwined, right? Arabic in Hebrew characters. So when he wrote not only his philosophical works, by the way, but his, for instance, his Pirush HaMishnayot was written in Judeo-Arabic. So I often get a good laugh out of in yeshivot, which I didn't know when I was a kid. But later on I realized, holy mackerel, right? You know, forests have been cut down. So much ink has been spilled on making diukim in, between contradictions. For instance, in the Sefer HaMitzvot, Sefer HaMitzvot was also written, his tabulation of the mitzvot, not the short tabulation before the Mishnah Torah, but his main tabulation where he explains each mitzvot was written in Judeo-Arabic. And often you have, this is an ongoing enterprise in yeshivot, the attempt to reconcile something he says in the Mishnah Torah with something he says, let's say, in the Sefer Mitzvot. Often it turns on a word, and it's a completely useless enterprise, almost totally useless, because they're written in different languages. I'm not saying always useless, but sometimes totally useless. So to give you one idea of such an enterprise, and this is probably the one that so much ink has been spilled over, and we'll get into that material. Yeah, so he starts off the Mishnah Torah with the following. Yisodei Yisodei Vamod HaChachmot Leida Shiesham Matsui Rishon. The very first paragraph in his Mishnah Torah, the foundation of all foundations, the pillar of all science, is to know that there is a first cause. Blah, 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 blah. This is the first mitzvah. Right? Leida. And then if you look at the Sefer HaMitzvot, which translated also by Ibn Tibbon, and we'll get to that in a minute, it says Lahamin. Okay, so now this is a tremendous opportunity for yeshiva guys. Okay, this is an opportunity. These things aren't problems. These things are opportunities, right? So what do you mean? In English, that sounds like a pretty major contradiction. Oh, sorry. Good. Please stop me if you don't know the Hebrew, and that's good. Nothing to be ashamed of. Lahamin means to believe. To believe. And Leida means to know. Yada. To know. This is a pretty major difference, right? To know means that I have to know something. Possibly it has empirical ramifications. Lahamin means to believe. Maybe the way we normally understand it, to take something on faith. Okay. They're written in two different languages. Not only that, translators, right? There is no such thing as a translation that is not already an interpretation. So people make this mistake, right? I mean, I can show you 20 different translations of the verse Bereshit bara Elohim, right? 20 different ones, right? The Revised Version, the King James Version, Hebrew versions, and they'll all be different. So you know already that a translation doesn't just mean a guy's translating it. People make decisions on how to translate a word, right? And that decision is already an interpretation. So when the Arabic to translator from the Arabic to the Hebrew made a decision about this Arabic word, lahamin, to translate it as lahamin. But those who know, there are scholars, there are not that many in the world. And for any of you who want to read the Sefer Mitzvot, I would strongly urge, there's one by a rabbi, Rabbi Chaim Heller, who knew Arabic. And you look at his long note there, and he says, this is an ambiguous word on Sefer Mitzvot, lahamin. Because the word in Arabic, itikad, right, can have different meanings. One of them is knowledge. So, sajagon, right, the famous kind of precursor to Maimonides, one of the Gaonim, one of the later Gaonim, who himself started a project that Maimonides would take further, that is the reconciliation of faith and religion. His book, does anybody know what his book, his famous philosophical work is called? Emunot V'Deyot. Emunot V'Deyot, the book of, translated as the book of beliefs and opinions. Beliefs and opinions. But the Hebrew, deot, is the same word that has been translated as emunah in Sefer Mitzvot. Deot. Right? So you understand? So that word could have, in Sefer Mitzvot, could have easily been translated exactly the same way as the Hebrew word that he uses in the Mishnah Torah. It could have said in Sefer Mitzvot, leida also, because the Judeo-Arabic word is capable of a number of different meanings. Okay, so all the drushes, now they may be dice drushes, and they may have meaning in and of themselves, but they have really nothing to do with the Rambam's work itself. So that's why we have to be careful when we look at, and I actually had a discussion with a very, very prominent, a number of weeks ago, a very prominent rabbi tapes and videos, and he told me, I've got a great thing on this contradiction. I listened, I didn't say anything. It was a great kind of insight that he had, but it wasn't an insight into Maimonides. It was an insight, his own insight into something else, using a kind of a false pretense. It's a false pretense. But that's another problem with the Rambam that I didn't mention, which is the language problem, which we always have to be wary of. So just to give you, again, an idea of the complexity of the man, we have a letter that he wrote to Shmuel ibn Tibbon. Ibn Tibbon there was part of a family, quite a prominent family, philosophers in their own right, wrote commentaries in their own right, were fairly prominent. Shmuel ibn Tibbon, who had quite a reputation, writes to Maimonides. We don't have that letter, but we have the response that Maimonides wrote to his request to meet with the Rambam because he wants to translate the Guide of the Perplexed. I want to come and meet with you because I need to clear up some things, right? I mean, there are a lot of problems here I'm having with the text. I don't know what you mean, as you can imagine. What's that?
And no internet.
There's a lot of not even. What do you mean? Internet? We don't have a printing press. Forget about internet, right? We don't have a printing press. So there are major problems. We have actually the response, the actual letter that he wrote, and from this letter we see once I read this letter, it just blew me away how he could have written what he did. It's incredible that he wrote what he did as it is, but considering the time that he devoted, And the way he divided his day up, it's just, I don't, it's not possible to me. But anyway, this is his letter, and then we'll get into the material. So he writes to, and it's very polite, very respectful. Now God knows that in order to write this to you, I have escaped to a secluded spot. So right away, I have to run away. I don't even have a place I can go to, right, where I can get a minute to myself, where people would not think to find me, okay? Sometimes leaning for support against the wall, so he's physically weak at this time. We know that he's already sick. We have other material that he's had sicknesses throughout his life, and he's physically kind of debilitated. Sometimes lying down on account of my excessive weakness, for I have grown old and feeble. So this is already the end of the 12th century. This is 1199. And so he's not that old by our standards, but medieval standards, it's pretty old already. Right? With regard to your wish to come here to me, I cannot but say how greatly your visit would delight me. So here's that, right? It would, but you know where he's going. For I truly long to commune with you and would anticipate our meeting with even greater joy than you. Yet, I must advise you not to expose yourself to the perils of the voyage. I mean, there's gonna be some, whatever, exposing yourself to marauders, robbers. This wasn't where you can just hop on a plane and be somewhere in an hour. For beyond seeing me and my doing all I could to honor you, give you a few kickles and a shot of scotch, you would not derive any advantage from your visit. Do not expect to be able to confer with me on any scientific subject for even 1 hour, either by day or by night, for the following is my daily occupation. So this is where we get a very important letter, because we get his actual Seder Hayom. I dwell in Mizrat Fostat, and the Sultan resides in Cairo. So Fostat is not actually Cairo, it's old Cairo, it's far away. These two places are about a mile and a half from each other. My duties to the Sultan are very heavy. I'm obliged to visit him every day, early in the morning, and when he or any of his children or any of the inmates of his harem, he actually, I think a major part of his job was actually ministering to the harem. And he has a lot of disparaging things to say about the surrounding culture's sexual habits, which again, he gets firsthand. He gets firsthand experience because he's dealing and ministering to the Sultan's objects of sexual gratification. That's what he's doing pretty well all day. I'm obliged, and when he, and not only the harem, but of course when he or any of his children need a freebie, right, I got to minister to them too. I do not quit Cairo, but must stay during the greater part of the day in the palace. It also frequently happens, again, that there are one or two of the royal officers that fall sick. I must attend to their healing. Hence, as a rule, I repair to Cairo very early in the day, and if nothing unusual happens, I do not return to Fostat until the afternoon. Then, I am almost dying with hunger. He hasn't had anything to eat. And what does he find? Right? I find the antechamber of my house, my office, filled with people, both Jews and Gentiles, because he's a famous doctor, right? Nobles and common people, judges and bailiffs, friends and foes. But when you need help, right, your enemy comes running. When you're the biggest doctor around, right, doesn't matter whether you've done something to offend the guy or hate the guy. A mixed multitude who await the time of my return and want prescriptions. That's what we're talking about here. I dismount from my animal, wash my hands, go forth to my patients, and entreat them to bear with me while I partake of a snack. The only meal I take in 24 hours. Then I attend to my patients, write prescriptions for their various ailments. Patients go in and out until nightfall, and sometimes until 2 hours and more into the night. I converse, prescribe for them while lying down from sheer fatigue. So he's actually, instead of the Freudian psychologist, he's on the couch. And his patients are standing up while he's like, almost collapsing from fatigue. In consequence of this, no Israelite, no Jew, can have any private interview with me except on the Shabbat. So only on Shabbat can I deal with rabbi matters. On this day, the whole congregation, or at least the majority of the members, come to me after the morning service, when I instruct them as to their proceedings during the whole week. So then they come to me with all their shilas, is Wrigley's chewing gum kosher, can I vote for the shus party? This is when they come to me with all their, right, shilas. We study together. I have a little bit of a class, right? I give a shir, probably not dafyomi, when they depart. Some of them return and read with me after the afternoon service until evening prayer. So here's the elite group that he studies with. In this manner I spend that day. I have here related to you only a part of what you would see if you were to visit me. Now, when you have completed for our brethren, the translation is already, of course, when you've completed it, I beg that you will come to me, but not with the hope of deriving any advantage from your visit as regard your studies. For my time is, as I've shown you, excessively occupied. So, a polite brush off, but brush off all the same. But there you get a small idea. And by the way, he's the rabbi. He is, there's some scholarly debate here whether he's officially Ras Al Yahud, that is the chief rabbi of the community, and he doesn't take any money for this. Okay, this is not a paid position. He earns his money, true to his own word, for those of you familiar with his Mishnah Torah, that is forbidden to take money for this kind of a function. So he was a man that was true to his own word. And imagine, I mean, this is, you know, this was the greatest posek of his time and of all time, and it wasn't his full-time job. Not by any. Well, this is the question.
that, did he
I don't know. I don't know if he doesn't. I don't know. No, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
It's a level of exaggeration. Is there any scholarly?
Well, you know, look. Even if you take
no,
it right, even if you take it that he's trying to brush him off, and he. But it's generally the consensus that this was probably what he did because we know that he worked in the Sultan's court. We know the distance that it was. We know that the reason he took on the profession was because his brother died, his younger brother, who actually supported the family. But again, what we have to remember is that he didn't take on the job of a ditch digger. That is, he took on this profession because he found this to be not a waste of time. That is, he found this to be knowledge that for him was Torah. That is, if I had to make money...
He didn't have a Sunday either.
What's that?
He didn't have a Sunday.
Right, right.
Did he have a Friday?
You mean like a...
Meaning because there were moms.
It's hard to know from the letter that we had, yeah.
The tone seems to be implying that from Sunday to Friday, he resents being compelled to deal with the Goyim, and that he's only available to the Jewish community on Shabbat.
It could be. I think what it is that he resents... not having to deal with a goyim, I think, and maybe we'll deal with that a little bit. His attitudes towards goyim, because the Rambam, just in short, was by and large, and I'm not saying that there are problems here and there in his halachic work, a universalist. That is, as opposed to, and this is a trend that I find very, very strong to this day, as opposed to kind of a essential superiority of Jews. That is, you find this very much today, right. largely influenced
that's
by.
That's why the Rambam says that a ger can say Elohei Avotenu.
That's right.
Bring the
that's right.
Whereas, and the Rishonim, other people did not allow
right.
it.
Right.
And we today, the Rambam treats a ger like a real Jew.
Right.
A full Jew, not everybody else did.
Right. Right. And that's I was going to the next class. I was going to actually go through that letter. No, because I actually wrote something on the letter, but by and large, universalist. That is, he did not believe in kind of genetic superiority, racial superiority. The Jews have something over the going because they have a teaching.
Right. But
they have a teaching.
According to my studies, he was compelled by an order of the court, so he had no choice. But also, it would have provided an excessively high pernas.
Right. I mean, he's making a living. Plus, I wouldn't, you know, all these things are not as straightforward. That is, I think there was also a great benefit. That is, he had available to him because of his position. Don't forget, again, we mentioned this is not only not the age of the internet, but not the age of books. Right? Books are hard to come by, but and not just Jewish books. We know that the Rambam was widely read, right? Himself widely versed in all the philosophical works of its time through Islam. So the court provided him with the opportunity for access to all this stuff, not just access to the material, but access to people who were the elite, right? The elite educated. So he was able to engage, and we don't know, but I assume.
It was very symbiotic.
Absolutely. he was in, all, including his halakhic work, His halakhic work could not, I think, could not have been written had it not been for Islamic culture. None of his works could have been written had it not been for Islamic culture. And we'll get into that in a minute. So this is the man we're dealing with. We're already an hour into it, but we'll jump into some of the material. That is what I wanted to do in this short kind of mini course, was to somehow look at the man as a whole. That is not to look at the guided flex or not to look at the Mishnah Torah, but somehow look at the Rambam and somehow show a symbiotic relationship between the halakhic Maimonides and the philosophic one, which is, I think is the correct way to go about approaching Maimonides. So we'll look, by and large, at the Mishnah Torah alongside pieces of the Guide and other works. But another thing that you have to understand when you're reading these things is that because of the complexity of the man, kind of you could see from what we've talked about, when he's writing, and he's explicit about this as well, he's writing for different audiences. So that doesn't mean, again, that one work is meant for one audience and another work is meant for another audience, but the same work itself is capable of being read in different ways by different audiences. And he was always, throughout his life, very, very conscious of this. And he says himself that he chose his words carefully in order to convey this. So, if you just look at the handout, and here I have the first source, which tells us the reason, I've skipped, obviously, a lot of the introduction to his Mishnah Torah, but tells us the reason why he wrote the Mishnah Torah. What brought him to write the Mishnah Torah? Which, of course, is the first real code, right? Long before the Shulchan Aruch. Nobody really before the Rambam had produced a comprehensive code of Jewish law. Right? Before the Rambam, you have some little attempts here and there, but before the Rambam, you wouldn't know what to do. Anybody who's familiar with the Talmud knows that it's really a scattered work. You can find tort law in the tractate dealing with Sabbath. You can find Sabbath law in those tractates dealing with torts, or those tractates dealing with family law. These are records. The Talmud are records of oral discussions. And if I played back the tape of this thing, right, of this class that I'm giving, you're probably going to be amazed at how I skipped from subject to subject. Right, we ended up. We started at point A, we ended up at point C. Any discussion that you would record between you and a friend, I can guarantee you, if it goes on for longer than 5 minutes, you're going to have discussed like about six different subjects. This is the nature of the Talmud. But you wouldn't know where to find anything. There's no index, right? At least not in those times. You wouldn't know, I gotta bake a cake on on Yontif. Can I do it in a certain way? I wouldn't know. I couldn't go to Moed Katan, or I couldn't go to Hilchot Shabbat, and I couldn't go there and just look and see. It doesn't work that way. The Rambam said this is no good. And it's no good for a number of reasons. It's no good, A, because I'm philosophically minded. Remember, the very first thing that he wrote, at least that we have of him, is a treatise on logic. So he hates confusion. He hates disorderliness. He hates being disorganized. He hates it with a passion. Right? He's an orderly person. So the Mishnah Torah is an attempt at organizing the law and classifying it. This is a huge, huge endeavor. Right? Make no mistake about this. This is a huge endeavor, especially when it is a groundbreaking endeavor. That is, nobody has done this before. So hold that for a moment. But here we're going to see another reason why he does it, besides kind of a philosophical reason. That is, I need to make order of this. I need to be able to classify things. Classifying things in itself is a philosophical enterprise. To know where things go. Does circumcision go under this heading, or does it go under another heading? Does it go under the book of what I call love? Does it go under some other book that is more appropriate? People have studied his attempt at classification. Classification itself gives meaning. That the very placing of halachot in different classes itself informs his understanding of that mitzvah. So here is part of his introduction towards the end of why he wrote the Mishneh Torah. So he goes on. I'm not going to go read the whole thing, but he basically says, and he brings a number of reasons. That is, this subject matter, this material is vast. Mitzvot, halachot are scattered throughout, not just the Talmud, but all kinds of sources, right? You have the Mishnah, you have the Talmud, you have Midrash Halacha, you have Tosefta, which is very, very rarely studied, even in Yeshivot. Sifreis, you have all kinds of sources that have to be mastered in order to know what to do. But beside from that, he starts off right away with some of the things I've already told you, with historical experience. Bizman hazeh takfu hatzarot yeterot, v'dachka hasha'a et hakol, v'abda chachma chachmenu binat nevonenu nistara. So it's been hard times. I've been wandering around. The nature of our historical experience is exile. So on top of, you have this incredible corpus of material that is almost impossible for unless you're part of the elite to master. You've also got the historical circumstances, which is exile. You have material being lost. You have confusion about things arising. And then he goes on to say that what I've done here, right, is to collect all these things from all these, you know, glean from all these compositions, b'lashon brura, v'derech tzara. This is, eight lines from the top. B'lashon brura, v'derech tzara, achete torah shebal peh, kulas dura b'fi akol, b'lo kushya v'lo piru. That is, I have organized this, gleaned everything from everywhere, so that there will be no doubts about anything. Now, obviously, anybody who's familiar with this knows he's failed miserably at this experiment. Not only are there no doubts, but his own work has become the subject of probably more study, I would say, that what he means. The heck does the Rambam mean here? Right.
The language he uses in the first line for why he's doing it sounds like the same thing Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi might have said when he decided to go and stop the process of it being
right.
Oral.
Right.
And yet Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the work that he compiled in the and the Gemara, is the work of many, many men and many different minds and many different opinions. But when the Rambam comes as one man and codifies, isn't he taking away some of the dynamic nature and in a way saying, I am the one that's going to make decisions, where in the past many people have contributed.
Absolutely, and you
it's a great loss.
Absolutely. So there are problems there, and the analogies are well taken. And he himself acknowledges the analogies between him and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That is, if you notice, the reasons are the same. That is, the times are difficult, things are being lost. He does the same thing in his introduction to the guide, which we'll look at. That is, there are things in the guide, for instance, that we're not allowed to talk about in public. Because I'm talking in the guide about very esoteric subjects that are now have been associated with Kabbalistic areas, but in his time, in the rationalist field, are associated with science and philosophy. But you're not allowed to talk about it publicly. But he uses the phrase "eit lasot l'Hashem." This is a phrase from in the Mishnah Brachot, that there are certain things heferu torotecha. That is, there are certain times when you're allowed to actually violate the law in order to save the law, right? So the most famous, for instance, example in halacha that's used for this is Eliyahu. Eliyahu at Har. The most famous biblical example is Eliyahu at Har Carmel. right? The Beit HaMikdash is standing, don't forget, right? Eliyahu challenges the priests of Baal to bring a korban. You bring a korban, I'll bring a korban. The problem is not bring a korban not in the Beit HaMikdash. How could Eliyahu, aside from, if there's any biblical scholars here, we'll leave aside any biblical criticism problems, but let's look at it traditionally, right, that there is an isur of bringing a korban in a bama, on an altar outside the Beit HaMikdash. How did Eliyahu do this? It's an absolute prohibition. The answer is, this is the classic paradigm, eight lasot l'Hashem. There's a time when I have to break the law in order to preserve the totality of the law, right? And this is the rationale that the Rambam is doing. But you're right, and we'll in a second look at one of the most prominent antagonists, so to call it, the Rambam, that raised this exact criticism. But the analogy is almost exactly the same as Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is doing the same thing. He's also taking many, many opinions, but he's one man. Don't forget, he's one man who writes it down, if it ever got written down, by the way. This is an incredible thing. We probably don't have anything that actually ever gets written down, known as the Mishnah.
It's
recited and repeated, but you don't have a text, probably. There are a few places in the Gemara, but by and large, the scholars, including Rashi, as opposed to Rambam, this is a raging debate, whether you actually have a text, right? Did the Amoraim go to a text and say, yeah, let's pick up the Mishnah? This is
Rabbi Haman
has
a whole.
What's that?
Rabbi Haman was doing. He talks about.
Oh, he does. Yeah. Right, but there is probably the most prominent Talmudist in the scholarly world. This guy Zussman in Hebrew U, still alive, wrote a very, very like a 200-page article on this, and this is going to be the last word on this, where he shows that there wasn't really until kind of after the Gemara is already compiled and finished. We're talking 6th, 7th century. You don't have really a text. But let's call it a text. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is still doing the same thing. He's also gleaning. And it's only one guy who writes it down. So the Rambam is also saying, this is not my own, although it is, in the end, its own. Like, that is, it's a product. Right? The same way the Mishnah... What's that?
Rambam will come to a stuck on every issue.
Right. He's extending Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's project. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's project failed to some extent because it gave rise. The Rambam also failed because he thought, I'm going to do one better then. I'm going to cut out all the machloket. That's what you're talking about, right?
And that is
Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, right? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, somewhat like legal reports. Larry can tell you about reading legal reports. That is often when you read a legal decision, they'll have the minority opinion and the majority opinion. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi collated those. The Rambam says, I'm going to get rid of all those. You don't need that. You don't need it. We just want the final word. So he went a little bit further, but. Look at what he says, and this may raise your ire a little bit more. Achi yu kol hadinin gluyin lekatan legadol. So he's already established his audience here, right? He's established one audience at least. That is all people, no matter how sophisticated they are, intellectually capable they are. That's who this is written to. Call mitzvah mitzvah, but then call it varim shetiknu chachamim and neviim. Klalo shel davar, shelo yehe kedei shelo yehe adam tzarich lechibur acher ba'olam. This got him into hot water, right? Nobody will need any other treatise ever, right? Bedin medine Yisrael ela yeh chibur ze mekabetz leTorah shebal peh kula imatakanot minagot zerot shenasu mimot Moshe Rabbeinu ad chibur haGemara v'kumo shepirshu lanu ga'onim kol b'chol chiburim shekluv achar Gemara lefichach. And now what I'm going to tell you is the reason that subsequently yeshiva world and Rabbi stayed away from what he's about to say. Therefore, I call this chibur ze Mishneh Torah. I call this something very audacious, and therefore. In the kind of yeshiva world, it often became referred to as the Yad HaChazakah, the strong hand, Yad being a numerical value of Yad being 14, which is the number of books that's been classified, because of the reticence. This is kind of audacious. What right does he have to say you don't need any other book, right? And this contains the entire book. And then you have exactly your objection. Here you have the Ravid, Rabbi Abraham ben David of Pasquier's, lived around the same time, who takes on the most prominent person to take on the Rambam and to knock him down. It was his project to knock him down. Right away in the Hakdama, there were already a few before questioning the Rambam's historical accuracy, and now he questions him altogether and says, you know what, this has never been done before. This is not possible. Hu azaf derech kol ha-mechabrim ha-shayu lefanav ki heim hebiu raya ledeveihem. So he brings up one of the greatest criticisms of the Rambam, that is, the Rambam, true to his word, that is, I don't have footnotes in this book. Right? So I'm just giving you what I have. I'm not going to have a footnote saying, see Baba Kama, page 70b. Right? So Ravid says, this is bad, right? For a number of reasons. A, we don't know what a source is. B, we know that throughout our history, we weigh things in terms of, you know, if some slouch says something against some big guy, we're going to take the big guy's words. I don't know where he got it from. He made decisions. There are bigger guys than him. Why should I rely on him? This is totally uncalled for, right? That's the Ravid's criticism. And then he says, I don't know his reasoning. I don't know why he picked one over the other. Very, very dismissive of this, as probably maybe he should have been. But one of the main reasons I'm pointing this out is the audience. That is, here's an audience that he's writing for, not the only audience, but it is, in one respect, a popular work. And so now, in order to end off the work, just end off the class so that people can get I want to tell you and read to you his other work, which was not written popularly, and the kind of audience that he carves out, which is very different than this audience. The Guide of the Perplexed, which is his philosophical work, was not even written as a book. For those of you who know, it was written much like those of you may be more familiar with modern philosophy. Franz Rosenzweig, who wrote his great Star of Redemption, one of the greatest kind of Jewish philosophers of the 20th century, wrote it on postcards. This is very much postcards from the front, actually. He was served in the First World War. He wrote it on postcards. It's very much like that. That is, the Rambam, it's almost like a huge letter. One long letter, or probably a series of letters, to his most prized disciple. That is, his most prized student who had gone through his rigorous curriculum. So just to give an idea, that is, in his introduction to The Guide of the Perplexed, he writes a dedicatory letter to his student Joseph Ibn Aknin, probably, where he says the following. My honored pupil, Rabbi Joseph, when you came to me having conceived the intention of journeying from the country farthest away in order to read, so here's a student who came from afar to read with him. The Rambam is in Harvard, right? He's the dean of Harvard Jewish Studies, and he's got somebody from Toronto that wants to come and study with him. I had a high opinion of you, and so now this is a very, very important letter because people kind of read this quickly, but it outlines the qualities that one needs in order for the Rambam to be addressing you in this work. One is, and people forget this, I had a high opinion of you because of your strong desire for inquiry and because of what I had observed in your poems of your powerful longing. So there are two traits here that are more emotional, intellectual, but have nothing to do with his intellectual sophistication. That is, you want to know. I don't want to hear from the guys that don't want to know. Right? I need those who long for knowledge. Right? Who have an incredibly overpowering yearning for knowledge. If you don't, right? But Michael, you don't have to come to my class. I don't really need you there. I don't want to cause problems where there aren't already problems. Right? This was the case. Since your letters and compositions in rhymed prose came to me, so he wrote to him in poetry, as very often the medievals did. I said, you know, this isn't enough. Intellectual curiosity, emotional feelings are not enough. So I question myself, perhaps his longing is stronger than his grasp. I still, even though, you know, you may want to know, but you may not be qualified to know. So I need you to pass an IQ test, right? So not only is it your emotional longing, but I need your IQ. When thereupon you read, so I tested you under my guidance, texts. Now here's the rub, okay? And many of you maybe have some of the Torah in Motion seminars I've been dealing with, the Slifkin affair and all this stuff. There's nothing to talk about here, okay? Here's what he says. You read texts under my guidance. Not Gemara first, not Tanakh, not Shilas and Tshuvas. You read under my guidance texts dealing with the science of astronomy. And prior to that, texts dealing with mathematics, which is necessary. He's studying that with Maimonides, which is necessary as an introduction to astronomy. My joy in you increased. It wasn't your lumbus. You didn't give me a pilpul, right? And I was wowed by, right? You didn't show me how veal is not kosher anymore, right? That was, you know, an incredible stroke of brilliance, but it doesn't really interest me. Then I saw that your longing, I saw the excellence of your mind, the quickness of your grasp. So then he understood that not only is he emotionally equipped, he's got the curiosity, but he's also intellectually equipped. When thereupon you read under my guidance text dealing with the art of logic, my hopes fastened upon you, and I saw that you were one worthy to have the secret of the prophetic books. Only then, only once we've mastered this curriculum, and he says it a number of times, and by the way, the first thing that we'll show in this symbiotic relationship is that this happens in the Mishnah Torah too. The work, this occurs as a chiyuv, right? An obligation to study these things, and I guess I'll show you that next week. However, let me just finish this. That is, we started to discuss the prophetic works. And what he means here is that, and this will lead us into the next class, that is, once you've mastered all this stuff, you are bound to have problems when we go back to studying our traditional foundational texts, primarily the Torah, right, the Tanakh. Because the Tanakh on this side, and Aristotle on this side, as interpreted by Islamic culture, just, you know, it's like magnets the wrong way. They just repel each other. I'm going to show you that that's not necessarily the case. Okay? So he says, now that you've moved away and we don't have a chance anymore to do this face to face, I'm going to do this by letter. That's the guide, right? And so that's what this book is about. And in a large part, what I'm going to try to show is what the Mishnah Torah is about too. Not just a halakhic work, right? Not just telling you what to do and what not to do, but interspersed throughout with philosophical reflections that interlock, as you used the word before, symbiotically with the guide, with his philosophical work. So
did he want lots of people involved more in the movie? In other words, it's like never if you've got all these questions, these philosophical problems, the Jews are not going to explain to you. But if you're, it's better be a katan and a gadol just concentrate on the Mishnah Torah, or it was an ideal, you know, those people, they don't even care about the philosophical issues. Because that's not clear from the letter.
Yeah, I think, I'll make it clear next week that he meant it for more than Joseph. But he did not mean it for the Ketanim.
Okay.
Or women, probably. But we'll talk about it next time. I don't want to paper over everything. Yes, we will. Yes,
okay.
We will.
Next Sunday, 9:30, of course, we're later on in the evening. We're having a program at 8 o'clock tonight at Shar Tfila for Yom HaShoah. Joseph Pollack, who is the head of Hillel at Boston University, runs the bakery, actually, in Boston, grew up in Montreal, was a trial survivor of Bergen-Belsen, speaking on the religious impact on survivors, which has been a lot written on recently, how it affected their views on Judaism tonight, 8 o'clock at Charcoal Mincha at 7:45. We'll make a minute at 7:45, 8 o'clock tonight. You saw E-Team that. You have to go to our website to sign up, torahinmotion.org. And hopefully we'll see you all next Sunday.